Council.
Good morning.
We're back on the record, September 14th, 2022, for our fourth of five cases this morning on the calendar. A220248 Aroma Shodu, I hope I pronounced that correctly, versus Swarovski North American Limited et al. Council, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I ask that you state and pronounce both your name and your client's name before you begin speaking, and let us know how you'd like us to identify you this morning. And with that, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Monpettit on behalf of the appellant, Miriam Aroma Shodu. Your Honor, you can identify me as he or his or counsel or hey you. It's all fine by me.
Thank you.
Your Honors, sort of in the interest and full disclosure, I have nothing new to add to what isn't already in my brief. It's well briefed by both parties. I do have some topics, however, that I would care to reinforce some concepts on. And the very first concept I want to reinforce and reiterate, because I think it's a bigger deal than the parties have led it to believe, or the court to believe, that is. And that is this: there is absolutely no evidence in this case that was before the district court that revealed that these earrings were in fact missing. Other than the allegation by Ms.
Wilkins.
I'm sorry,
can you repeat I didn't quite hear it.
There is no evidence in the record that these earrings are in fact missing.
Are what?
Missing.
Missing, okay.
Gone.
All right, okay.
Sorry, that's okay.
There's no evidence of that. Nope, that's okay, Your Honor. You're not hearing me or my enunciation is poor, I apologize. There is no evidence that any of these earrings that are alleged to have been missing are gone. And really what we have is we have Ms. Wilkins, who her own counsel describes as forgetful, indicating that they're gone. That is issue number one I want to reinforce. Issue number two.
So is that pertinent? Is that germane to a credibility determination that you believe a jury has to make about whether Ms. Wilkins is truthful in her statement to
law enforcement?
Yes.
Yes. I agree with the court's observation on that. I think that that is a credibility determination. I think that everything that Ms. Wilkins says is subject to a credibility determination. That is not for something that the district court should decide, but yet should leave it up to a jury to make those credibility determinations. Your Honors, I also think that it goes towards establishing the prima facie case for discrimination. I also think it goes directly towards this concept of defamatory per se and whether or not they can invoke.
What exactly, refresh my recollection, Mr. Monpettit, exactly what was the defamatory statement, word for word?
The defamatory statement was falsely accusing my client of stealing earrings from the Swarovski store.
So she said to the police, Your client stole these earrings. That's the defamatory statement.
That is the defamatory statement, which the police later proved to be false. She didn't steal anything.
Wasn't it that she definitively stole?
She said to the police with certainty.
With certainty.
With certainty. With certainty, the black Muslim woman who, while in the store with two white women, stole the earrings, which I'm not even sure are missing. My memory is that they're missing, but I've never done an inventory, I've never done a check, I've never looked. I've never ascertained.
Well, but she did say she looked. I mean, in her deposition, she said, I looked every place. I looked to see if they fell in between counters. I looked here. I looked every place.
She did say that, Your Honor, and that's a great observation. But looking is a far cry from conducting an inventory to actually make sure that you didn't sell them and forget, that they didn't go somewhere else and you misplaced them. They've never done an inventory search in this store, which is a small store, 440 square feet, very small room. They've never done an inventory search, and sort of begs the question why, but that's something I think a jury should consider. And
so what is the evidence undermining the store's claim of pretext that well, she was the only person looking at those specific earrings?
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. I mean, I think the one fact issue that drives away from that is Ms. Romeshadu testified specifically that she wasn't the only one who came into contact with that spinner. There was a white customer in there as well who also came into contact or was very, very near the spinner. But all three of these individuals were well within that area of the store, and two of them were well within the area of the spinner. And I think that what that does, Your Honor, is it creates a fact question for a jury to make that determination as to whether Ms. Wilkins had a reasonable or probable cause to report Ms. Romeshadu as the one who committed the theft.
Can I ask a question about the negligent infliction of emotional distress claim?
Yes.
That issue was fully briefed before the district court. You would agree?
I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay. The nature of her damages. On appeal, the respondent argues that the nature of her damages do not rise to the level such that there's a cognizable claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress. And your response is the district court didn't decide it.
My response is really twofold. Correct. The district court didn't decide it. They didn't render a decision on that. And so as an error-correcting court, that really isn't an issue here.
But it was fully briefed below, and
it was fully briefed below, but we don't know how the district court would have decided that question, and so I think it's...
But we have a record.
We do have a record.
So what is the record of her damages that would qualify as rising to the level of a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim, assuming we reach that issue?
Her emotional distress and the fact that she did seek treatment for this very incident, Your Honor.
So my understanding of the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that she went to three counseling sessions,
correct.
Is that right?
That's correct.
She reported that she was, and that was in November of 2019.
Correct.
And that she had trouble sleeping, inability to concentrate, fearful of social situations. Understandable. I understand her reports. Are those symptoms and the attendance of three counseling sessions, is that enough to reach the threshold damage level such that there's a cognizable negligent infliction of emotional distress claim?
Absolutely. It's a question for a jury, Your Honor.
And what's your best authority for that proposition?
I don't have a case or a case site that says, Your Honor, and I can't think of a case, you know, practicing in this area for 25 years, I can't think of a case that says there's a minimum threshold for that. And typically the cases that, and I can't quote them by name, but they generally say you have to have some form of treatment. You have to have seen a therapist or seen a doctor or seen a physician or done something to achieve that. There is another line of cases that say you don't really need anything. You can show up and testify to your own emotional distress. And there are cases and claims that recognize that. Again, I
think that's true in a garden variety negligence
claim.
Correct. But we're talking about a specific kind of negligence, which I think has a little bit of a higher standard.
It does have a little bit of a higher standard, and that's where I get into the cases that say you have to have sought treatment or done something.
Okay.
And this wouldn't be a garden variety, you know, common law sort of emotional distress damages claim where you don't need to see a provider or somebody to counsel you, Your Honor.
Okay.
And how do you respond to the zone of danger? I mean, historically, at any rate, there was a requirement for some kind of physical zone of danger.
Correct. And the case law on that, and it's well briefed in there, Your Honor, it's very clear that in a defamation per se case, you don't need to be within the zone of danger. That's the only type of case where that's not a requirement, that it be within the zone of danger, Your Honor.
Can I ask you some questions about the application of a qualified privilege in this case?
Yes.
I mean, the argument that you're making is that the defamatory statement was motivated by a discriminatory animus.
Correct.
In that situation, assuming that there's some question of fact as to what the motive of the speaker was in making a defamatory statement, is it your view is that that would convert what would traditionally be determined as a matter of law, the application of qualified privilege, to one of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, because, you know, as we stated in the brief, the question of good faith is one of fact and for a jury. And that has been the precedential rule here in Minnesota for 140 years, going back to the Cygnurant versus Fahey, 6 Northwest 2nd, 403, 1880. That's what it's been for the last 140 years, is that the question of good faith is one of fact and for a jury.
And if a speaker is speaking with a discriminatory animus in making a defamatory statement, is it your claim that that would per se, that's a poor choice of words, but a poor phrase there, but it would per se disqualify the application of a qualified privilege because it's not made with a proper motive or good faith?
Oh, if I understand the court correctly, I mean, and maybe I can answer the court this way. Falsely accusing someone of a crime is defamatory per se. At that point, you then sort of invoke this qualified privilege, and that's what is the jury question. I mean, what judge can decide on a summary judgment motion at the district court level whether it was good faith or not? That's a fact question, and that's why the precedent has been around for 140 years.
But there are summary judgments granted on qualified privilege. So it's not all, I mean, I know the cases say it's generally a fact issue, but.
And I think that's a good question, Your Honor, and that is, you know, Wilkins engaged in an investigation, such as, she didn't engage in an investigation, she kind of looked around, and from her memory, she said, these are missing. You know, that's a far cry from an inventory search, actually confirming that the merchandise is missing. You know, she relied, again, on her memory, which they describe her as forgetful. You know, ARG as a group made zero effort to determine if the subject earrings have even went missing, that they weren't sold somewhere else, that somebody else didn't sell them the night before or whatever. I mean, therein lies the fact question as to whether or not her accusation is made in good faith. And there are facts from which a jury can conclude, granted, it's circumstantial, but that's still evidence from which a jury could conclude that it was not made in good faith, that she didn't have a proper occasion.
You know, back and forth in the briefs, everyone keeps saying there are material facts in dispute. You know, and everyone's, you know, whether there were two people in the store, three people in the store, I'm not so sure that those facts are in dispute, as the issue for reversing the grant of summary judgment is the reasonable inferences, which we should do in your favor, you know, that would suggest she was acting for a motive not of just, you know, reporting that this person stole it, but she was, you know, anti-Muslim. Would you agree with me?
I would agree with you that the brief.
I mean, what material facts are in dispute? I mean, if in one deposition, you know, she doesn't say categorically, well, there were two people in the store and you proved by some other witness that there were three people in the store. Well, that's not in dispute. She testifies, well, first I thought it was two, then it was three. I mean, that's inconsistent, but that's not necessarily a material fact in dispute.
Correct, and Your Honor is correct. It is the inferences from the evidence.
Assuming, which we do, all reasonable inferences in your favor that the employee was acting in a discriminatory fashion, what do you think is the most important fact that we should infer that, you know, she was not acting in good faith, that she believed your client had stolen the earrings? What do you think is the strongest one? I have my thoughts, but I'll ask you first.
Well, I hope your thoughts mirror mine. Your Honor,
we'll see you in 90 days.
I'm not going to hold my breath. Your Honor, I think the biggest fact is this, that one can infer from the inconsistent statements from Ms. Wilkins that she told varying stories over a prolonged period of time, both to the police, all within the same 15 or 20 minutes that the police were there, and a different story to her employer. And I think the inference that a reasonable juror could draw from that is that she did that to avoid the animus of being discriminatory. So I don't think it's really one fact. I think it's a congregation of facts. I don't think anybody can look at any case that's ever been before this court and say, what is the one fact? It is a litany of facts that the jury and any reasonable juror could infer that the reporting of this was done for, well, not in good faith, Your Honor.
Can I ask one
of course.
Quick question? Okay. Well, maybe quick. So I've just got an evidentiary question.
Sure.
So to the extent you're relying on inconsistencies in Ms. Wilkins' statements to police and to the management of the store, we're relying on a police report and then the store's incident report. So am I missing something in the record, or is there actual sworn testimony about, or is this not hearsay because you're not trying to assert it for the truth of what's in those documents?
Well, the from the store was a handwritten statement, Your Honor.
Oh, so there's a handwritten of her.
Yes.
Okay.
A handwritten
All right. Thank
statement
you. Okay.
Of her. And then you have the police information. Now, obviously, you know, having tried lots of cases, we can impeach witnesses with those things. We can put them on the stand. We can impeach them. We can call the police officer to the stand to impeach them with what she told them.
But on summary judgment, does it meet the summary judgment standard to put those into evidence? I'm struggling with that at the moment, so it's not like I know the answer.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood you.
Your
question as being one for a little further down the road at trial in this case.
Yep.
No, Your Honor, on summary judgment motion, the evidence that is before the court is contained in the deposition transcript and the questions that were asked of Ms. Wilkins. That's the under oath testimony. But I think the district court also needed to consider that there are these variables and variations which could be utilized down the road in a trial, Your Honor, if that answers your question.
But in her deposition testimony, she didn't, or did she acknowledge, and I read through her testimony, but I just can't remember now. Did she acknowledge that she said different things at different times? I mean, to the store management and to the police?
She acknowledged what she told the police.
Okay.
And then she acknowledged in her deposition testimony as well that, you know, in fact, there were three people in the store, one of which was my client, Ms. Ramachandran.
Okay, thanks for humoring me. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
No, and if I wasn't answering your question, I apologize. But I see my red light is blinking, and so I will remove myself from the podium. Thank you.
Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Ruska on behalf of the respondents, and you can address me as he, him, or his. And I represent Airport Retail Group, Stellar Partners, and Lauren Wilkins in this matter. This court should affirm the district court's order granting respondents summary judgment for two primary reasons. First, Wilkins' rationale for identifying appellant to MSB police has always stayed the same, and appellant's inferences drawn from different alleged inconsistent statements in the record are unreasonable. And second,
you know, so on the second point, and I am inclined to agree that, you know, whether she remembered there was two or three people, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the one that I find most troubling for in terms of a reasonable inference is when she said, I knew, well, and I'm paraphrasing, but I knew she did it because I looked at the security tape and the cameras don't work. I mean, speaking for myself and not my chair's colleagues, that's a big problem for me. I mean, that's just not true. I mean, there was no security tape to look at because the cameras didn't work. So couldn't you make a reasonable inference that she's lying and that she did have the woman arrested because she was a Muslim and, you know, she doesn't like Muslims, or at least that's enough to get to a jury? I mean, first of all, am I correct in stating that that's what the record indicates? She said she looked at I looked at the tape and, you know, that's how I knew she did it. And then it's not in dispute that the cameras don't work.
So I understand, so no, Your Honor, and the reason why is, so I understand that there were two sets of cameras, so the cameras inside the actual jewelry store itself weren't working, but Ms. Wilkins looked at the camera that was available to the actual airport, which she wouldn't have had access to at the time. I believe
we'll check that, but so this is a camera outside looking in?
Right, so those are the, when there's a reference to video footage, it would be video footage that wasn't the store's video footage, but MSP's airport video footage looking in. And so I believe on page 41 or 42 of her deposition transcript, when she stated that she initially said that there were two total customers in the store and realized there were three, she said that she viewed the video about last summer, so a year prior, I believe it would be. So it would be a year after the incident, so in 2020, which would have been a year before her actual deposition testimony. So that's how she later said that when she was making her decision at the time, she believed there were only two total customers in the store, the appellant, Ms. Aroma Shodu, and the customer to whom Mr. Wilkins was helping. But then when she later looked at the airport camera a year later, and she realized there was a third customer. And so that's why, as you were kind of getting at earlier in the previous argument, that's not a disputed material fact. She acknowledges that there are three customers in the store, but she has always maintained that she identified Ms. Aroma Shodu because she had believed that there were only two customers in the store at the time.
But didn't she tell the police officer that she looked at the video?
My recollection from the police report, Your Honor, was that she identified appellant based off of seeing her near the jewelry. I don't think she said anything about the video because she was not able to look at the video. She believed it was fixed, or there's evidence in the record saying that they believe there should have been video, but the actual video of the store itself was inaccessible.
What do you make of the fact that the police officer in his report discounted her statements and abandoned the investigation because of her inconsistencies?
I make the fact that the police officers abandoned the investigation because after searching the appellant, they didn't find the missing earrings at issue, and she had a receipt for a purchase at the store. Obviously, the officers acknowledged that there were inconsistent statements made, but as I believe Ms. Wilkins stated in her deposition, in her 4 years of working at the store, she had never encountered a theft before, and so she admitted that she was flustered and having to talk to the police at that time.
But at this point, at this procedural posture, we accept all inferences in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, which in this case is Mr. Romadoshu. So, again, what do we make of the fact that when determining whether there was a proper motive for or a discriminatory motive for the actions of the manager, what do we make of that piece of evidence in the record that there were inconsistencies in the actual reporting of this incident to the airport police, as determined by the police?
Well, the inconsistent statements that are being alleged are different from the actual underlying rationale for why Ms. Wilkins identified Ms. Aroma Shodu in the first place.
Isn't that something that the jury gets to decide? I mean, from my perspective, to be to sort of jump to the end of my thought process, is we have credibility questions about the that are identified in the record based on these inconsistent statements and also by another witness to this incident. And so when there are credibility questions about reporters, usually those have to be resolved by the fact finder, not the district court judge.
My response, Your Honor, is that that Ms. Wilkins had still stayed consistent as to why she identified Ms. Aroma Shodu throughout the entire case. So, for instance, she identified, Ms. Wilkins believed at the time that there had only been two customers, and in fact, the record shows that only appellant was interested in and handled the eventual missing merchandise.
I get what she says. The question is whether the jury gets to decide whether her belief was reasonable based on all of the evidence that's been presented in the record, that there were more than two customers, that there were inconsistent statements to the police officer, that Ms. Aroma Shodu actually made a purchase that your client didn't remember.
But those facts aren't material to the actual decision to potentially deny Ms. Aroma Shodu full and equal enjoyment.
Makes her a less reliable witness, though. Doesn't that go to her good faith? I mean, she said, oh, this was traumatic for me, and I don't remember who was in the store. But then at other points, she says, it's a very small store, and I watched very closely. And so she's the only person who could have. So it seems like it goes to the qualified privilege issue as well as pretext. And that seems like kind of so why is that not a fact issue?
So you're right, Your Honor, that the good faith issue goes more towards the defamation claim and not just the MHRA claim. But again, it's the inconsistent statements are different from her actual rationale. And the actual rationale for identifying appellant has been the same throughout the entirety of the case. And whether or not there was two or three pieces of jewelry missing, that doesn't change the reason that Ms. Wilkins identified Ms. Aroma Shodu, which was because she was the only one to have, in the record, to have handled the missing jewelry. She was the only one who was interested in the same type of missing jewelry. And that there
well,
was
that's, the, that's not true, though, because it said the other customer was very was right at the same counter, correct?
Yeah, so, Your Honor, if you look at the briefs, the appellants will always say that the other customer was in close proximity, but they never say that she was at the spinner rack or interacted or otherwise handled the same missing jewelry. And that's because there's no facts in the record to show that the other customer was indeed at the spinner rack.
But there was a third person in the store, and if Ms. Wilkins, I'm sorry, no, appellant, put the boxes back, but didn't do the most thorough job, so they were kind of easy for that third person to come in and just nab and go. That's a reasonable possibility, isn't it? And the question is whether other options should have been considered by Ms. Wilkins.
I would say that's speculative, Your Honor, and it would be insufficient to survive summary judgment because there are no facts in the record showing that this other customer was otherwise interested in the same jewelry. And so that's the difference between that sort of, reasonable inference. There's got to be some sort of basis in fact there, and there just isn't any sort of basis in fact there.
If you look at the Young case, the discrimination or the employment discrimination case, and yes, there's no doubt that, if you believe someone is stealing, that, that's a non-contextual reason to act. But, in the discrimination case, it's sort of, we look at, okay, were there inconsistent reasons that the employer gives for why the employee is fired? And I can't remember, the Eighth Circuit was going on and on about how, they said he was incarcerated and in reality he was just subpoenaed or something. So, but the focus, they focused on different reasons that they gave, which gets you, because if you then, they have different reasons. What is the reason they fired? And maybe it is really because they were discriminated against this individual. I think this is the guy who lost his foot. So in this case,
okay, yes, you know, it would be a non-discriminatory reason if you believed that the plaintiff, you know, had stolen the earrings. But in, but then we look, just as in Young, we look at, okay, well, were there any inconsistencies in her statements that would detract from her belief that this person stole it? And if there were, then we infer against your client that, well, maybe she was just going after this person because she was wearing a headdress. So, I mean, if that's the case, couldn't we look at all of these statements that Judge Frisch has been talking about, that Judge Siegel has been talking about, you know, I've been talking about the camera, and we're going to look at that, and say, well, you know, there's enough inconsistency here that would suggest you could infer that she was acting for other than in good faith, and therefore go to trial and you know, have a nice day. I mean, so why am I wrong? Why am I wrong? Why are all these inconsistencies, why do none of them matter, and none of them can be indicative of a motive other than, hey, I thought this was the person who was stealing, so go get her.
I'm not saying that they don't matter, Your Honor. It's, and I'll get to your point.
Well, I mean, how would any inferences that suggest discrimination would be so unreasonable as a matter of law, it should not go to the jury?
It would be the inconsistent statements that are directly tied to the actual underlying rationale for why the identification took place. So, for instance, in the employment context with Young, there was an employer who terminated an employee who was black for deficiencies in job performance. And then after the EEOC, and that's at page 1020, and after the EEOC gets involved, the employer switches the actual reason for why they terminated that individual. And so again, as we point this out in pages 22 and 23 of our brief, there's this element of time. So time had elapsed. It wasn't just the same day and hours. It was days. I believe the case said it shortly after. And it's the actual reasoning itself. So it wasn't just, they later say that they terminated the employee because there was no other work. So it's this difference between this person was terminated because of a lack of available work versus, deficiencies in job performance. And that's diametrically different from what occurred here. In this case, Ms. Wilkins has consistently said and stated the reasons for why she identified the appellant. And yes, there are inconsistencies in the record as to maybe the number of earrings she originally said that may have been gone. And there are inconsistencies as to how many individuals that she believed were in the store at the time. But she's acknowledged them and has stated that at the time of the decision, she believed there were only two people in the store. And she chose the appellant due to her actual handling of the jewelry because she was with the other customer the entire time.
Well, that she got her hand caught in the proverbial cookie jar for realizing that she had made a misstatement of fact, doesn't that create some sort of a fact question that the jury has to answer about her credibility? Do we credit her statement now that she's realized that she had to correct herself because when confronted with objective facts, she had no choice?
But the facts that about the number of the jeweler, like, you know, when you're reporting a theft, it's still going to be a theft whether it's one piece of item stolen or two or three. So that's my point is that inconsistency isn't material to her determination of why she reported the appellant in the first place, Your Honor.
I need to ask you a couple of questions. I know you're running short on time, and you can go over the time period. I have a few questions. Generally, the application of a qualified privilege in a defamation per se case is a question of law. If there is a question of fact as to whether the speaker is motivated by a discriminatory animus, do you agree that the application of a qualified privilege would become a question of fact?
In case you're wondering, that's a trap.
So I took a pause, Your Honor.
Now you got to answer it, though.
I still contend that in this case there isn't a fact dispute as to whether she acted in good faith.
I appreciate the factual context, but my question is one as a general proposition of law. We generally apply a qualified privilege as a matter of law. I think there's an exception when the motive of the speaker is contested. If the speaker was acting in good faith or with a proper purpose, and the parties are contesting what the motive of the speaker is, doesn't that convert the application of qualified privilege to one of fact?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because as we state in pages 31 and 32, there are a handful of cases, and I believe Judge Siegel pointed that out, that summary judgment was still granted. And in every one of those defamation cases, the opposing party is always going to say that there's an issue as to the good faith. They're always going to challenge the reporter's credibility and what have you. But in those cases...
In any of those cases, I don't believe the... I think the answer to this question is no. None of those cases were alleging that the speaker was motivated by a discriminatory animus.
No, Your Honor, I believe, for instance, the Mukherjee case was involving an individual sexually assaulting children, and in the Zine case, there was individuals that were not, under any sort of protected status. So I suppose I would agree with you there, yes.
And would you also agree that if a speaker is, in fact, motivated by a discriminatory animus, they are not acting in good faith or with a proper purpose?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. If there is discriminatory animus, that I would agree with you.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel this morning? Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Mompettit?
I have no rebuttal. The court has a great command over the information and had great questions, so thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. Appreciate your excellent briefing and argument today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion in the statutory time period. Thank
Please
you.
Please give my warmest regards to Andrew Peterson, Mr. Ruskin.
I will, Mr.